Welcome everybody to Space Force. Today we are going to look at Star Trek V: The Final Frontier. I am your host, Jason Tondro.
I'm Jim.
I am and will always be A. Smith.
And I am Professor Christopher McLaughlin, occasionally known as Professor McGee, the God.
God. Nice.
The God. THA God. I'm trying to make that my thing now.
You're at the right movie then. because that's all we're going to talk about. For those of you that are longtime listeners of the show, you know that when we first started, we found out that Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, is Jim Seals' favorite Star Trek film. Now, considering this film was widely reviled as one of the absolute worst in the franchise, We've long known that he had some explaining to do, and we didn't think he would ever get a chance to actually do that until we ran out of Picard episodes. And he suggested we do the movies. And at first, Jim thought we'd only be doing Star Trek V. Oh, no. No, we're doing all of them. And we're just hitting this one after a long buildup. But we've got a big team here, and we all just watched the show. Of course, we all have a lot of strong opinions already formed about it, but I think that it's interesting to look at the film with a fresh eye after many years. And maybe we can take a step back and look at how this film, at first, what was Star Trek like when this film was being made? Chris, can you start us off? Like, what was the state of Trek? What was the Trek experience back in the 80s when this film was being made?
Well, you know, it's so funny. The last non-Trek film that I saw was I went back and watched The Wolf of Wall Street on Blu-ray.
Oh,
and it's this classic Scorsese story about people who get to the top and then just fall down in the most epic way possible.
Right.
And at least, you know, on a thematic level, it dovetailed nicely with what we're talking about here now, because at the time that Star Trek V comes out,
yeah.
You've got, I mean, they're arguably at the franchise's peak. I mean, Star Trek IV has become the most financially profitable, most beloved by the mainstream Star Trek thing ever done. And they, at least, you know, from a creative point of view, they're out of the, they've resolved everything they need to resolve in that middle trilogy.
Yep.
2, 3, or 4, they have the creative freedom to really go off and do anything they want. And well, they decided to do what they did.
Kirk is a captain again.
They've got a ship and they beat the rap.
And at the same time on television, those first two seasons of Next Generation are kind of a shakedown cruise of its own, right? Like,
it's funny. My memories of actually having seen the film, rather than that long drive back from our rural Virginia theater with one of my best Star Trek buddies, in the whole car ride, just periodically going, "What the fuck? What the hell was that?" And we didn't get to see it till a Saturday because the summer of '89 was just crazy movie wise.
Yeah.
But I remember coming home that Saturday. And I watched a Star Trek Next Generation episode.
Yeah.
And I was trying to figure out which one. And I was going through the list of Next Gen episodes that were airing about that time.
Yeah.
And I've got Manhunt, Lwaxana Troi, enough said.
Right.
There is the really cool episode at The Emissary where we get to meet Worf's baby mama.
Okay.
And then you go from, and then there's a semi decent episode where peak performance where they have to repair the junkie ship to fight do a mock battle with the Enterprise, about a month after Final Frontier comes out, you get what is universally regarded as the worst Next Gen episode ever, the clip show they did, Shades of Grey,
Riker's brain,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So Next Gen is in the process of becoming watchable.
Yeah. Okay.
At this point.
Yeah, but season two is still really does stink of classic Trek. It's got the Real in it, which is always the one I always reference as being, oh my god, it's the Real. What's season two? What a surprise. But as you mentioned,
In Next Generation's defense, they do have Measure of a Man.
Yes, that's the crazy thing.
So good that CBS just based a whole season of Picard mostly on that episode.
And this is why it's so weird, because again, I went through the episodes and thinking, okay, where are we? And I think, okay, yeah, Measure of a Man, we mentioned then Picard, season two, and then you get the Royale. The emissary, I want to say Kalea, is that the name of the Klingon bassinet? But anyway, she's obviously takes a lot of her pointers from the Klingons in this.
Yeah.
The costume, the appearance, there's a lot of her, or one way or another, there's either cross-pollination between the two, because I believe that's the first time we see Klingons properly in Next Generation. They may be around in kind of, I think that's the first kind of thing. And as we were saying about the last movie, Klingons in those are more honor-bound warriors rather than just scheming bad guys like they were in Classic Trek.
Well, earlier that season, you got the a Matter of Honor, the one where Riker becomes an officer, and then end of season one, you had Heart of Glory, where Worf meets the renegade Klingons, and you know you get the Klingon death yell and all that cool stuff.
That's kind of concurrent with Star Trek 4 and Star Trek 5, then, isn't it? Yeah. So at least they're building upon that kind of what we've seen before in the movies.
So in many ways, the building of Klingons had been going on in Next Generation before this film, Final Frontier, comes out.
Yeah.
And so we're sort of tapping into that. Jim?
Yeah. So I think the big sea change with this film is it's the full Star Trek film that comes out when you can watch Star Trek at home for free.
Okay.
Right? Like that's sort of like when you talk to Ralph Wino and he does interviews about it, he says, yes, the movie's flawed, but the biggest thing is people could stay home and watch Star Trek.
Well, and in many, to me, I would think, does that create a bunch, that changes the movie watching experience, because now Star Trek is not the big prestigious once every few years phenomenon it had been. Now Star Trek comes out every week, so the movie is just not that big of a deal, frankly.
That, and like if Wrath of Khan had come out and there was another show called Star Trek, Wrath of Khan would still be a thing.
Okay.
Like it is a wonderfully constructed film.
Right.
It's not just the best, you know, quote unquote, best quality wise Star Trek film.
Yeah. It's a good movie. Yeah.
This, and the reason why I love Star Trek V is it's just an episode of the original series.
But longer, and
it's longer, it's bigger, it's a little more garish,
but
it can fit formally into anything of season three.
I see. All right,
and watch mediocre Star Trek from the Next Generation reusing old scripts of Star Trek Phase Two.
Right. I say, as far as I'm aware, in the UK, we didn't get Next Generation to a little bit later for at least the first couple of seasons, so I think Star Trek VI was the first time that you'd been watching it at home, and then you could go and see the actual movie version. So 5, I think, was a kind of in that gray area where they may not have started yet, but I could be wrong.
Now, and Aid, you suggested that I have a note from you. Next Generation development around Trek 4 to 5 was a way of keeping Trek on television without paying Shatner and Nimoy's salaries. It was a way to do Trek on the cheap.
This is apparently one of the reasons they did it. Yeah, this is again, just reading through notes I've seen elsewhere. One of the things was like, okay, yeah, they're asking for loads of cash. How can we keep this going? We invent a new crew. We bring it on television. So obviously by now we're 2 seasons in. So obviously it must have at least, you know, stayed its welcome over one season shows that just dies off and that's it. So it obviously worked. And obviously, we know the future of Trek anyway. So
now, there's a famous story that Nimoy, of course, gets to direct Star Trek IV, Voyage Home, and that because of their most favored nation status, whatever Nimoy gets, Shatner can get. So Nimoy tells Shatner, like, you could probably direct the next one if you push for it, because I got to direct this one, so they feel obliged to give it to you. And this leads us to him directing Star Trek V, and the infamously terrible nature of the film, the fact that it has this rep as a huge bomb, partly feeds into and is fed by Shatner's reputation as a, you know, kind of overwrought ham actor. But let's talk about the making of the movie. So,
That's where you're immediately in trouble here.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You see, because you have the studio wanting to make one film and Shatner wanting to make another.
Okay, so tell us about those two different movies. What you know, is Shatner and what is... We have a... Carrie has chimed in. Carrie from Critical Hit Cookies, thank you so much for showing up. I have a box of your stuff in the refrigerator, which I am not going to torture the guys with me eating on camera. But thank you for coming, for cheering in. So Chris, you're saying there's two different movies. Can you tell us what those two different movies are?
Well, Shatner's idea, he's in love with two ideas. And the first one speaks very, very deeply to who Shatner is as a man.
Okay.
Shatner is not a genius in the sense that, you know, he could have gone off and, you know, gotten a PhD had he not decided to, you know, do Star Trek and promise margarine commercials and things like that. But Shatner has always had this amazing curiosity about him.
Okay.
You know, I love one of the things I like about what I've read about Bill Shatner as a person is he's got this wide range of interests. Even at 88, he's still out trying new things.
Yeah.
And his approach to religion and spirituality is the same thing. One of the things that really, really affected me about reading about him is how just shattered he was by his father's death while the original series was in production. Okay. And there's this really, really sweet story about how Shatner was on the plane from L.A. back to Montreal. And just talking to people on the plane about, you know, what do you believe about, you know, is there a God? If so, what is he, she, or it like?
Yeah.
And Shatner, ever since that day, has been on a lifelong quest to find the meaning of it all. It's been a legit quest of his. Mm-hmm. I think one of the if you really understand Shatner, one of the really obscure pieces to the Shatner puzzle is he made one of the classic 1976 what I like to call crocumentaries. You know, those great looking for Bigfoot, looking for Loch Ness Monster documentaries that were all over the place in the 70s.
He's
got a classic one called Mysteries of the Gods. And okay. Shatner is talking to everybody from like Jesko von Puttkamer, the NASA guy that helped with the wormhole stuff on Star Trek One, to the infamous psychic Gene Dixon. And he's just sitting there rapt attention, giving them all equal consideration and equal interest. You know, and it's just incredible to me. It tells you a lot about Shatner. So Shatner's lifelong quest to find God, he, in the light of things, not surprisingly, wants to film that.
Okay.
So he runs head on into a studio that is still busy counting the money from that funny Star Trek.
Yeah. Right.
So the compromise they try to go with is Shatner wants to make this deep religious statement whose big plot twist is that Bones and Spock are going to turn on Kirk.
Right.
And Kirk is going to have to fight everybody, including his best friends and surrogate family, while the studio wants something funny. And, you know, it reminds me of one of the great throwaway MST gags is Dr. Forrester is cleaning out his old Maddox science experiments. He goes, oh, this is where I sewed the butt of a dog onto the butt of a cat.
Okay.
You know, it's just not going to work. Okay. There's just no way this is going to work. And then... It just sort of falls apart from there. You have a comedy being made by people that don't want to make a comedy, and you have a film about religion made by a guy that doesn't really grasp the subject. I mean, I laud Shatner's curiosity again, but like as far as what he actually knows about the topic, no, 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 no.
Now, I have read that Roddenberry was pretty upset with Shatner and felt like Shatner had stolen his plot from the Godhead.
You know, that's the amazing thing about it. You have Star Trek IV, which last week I argued is this wonderfully Jewishly theological Old Testament wrath type film.
Right.
And becomes the biggest success in Star Trek history. And by default, Star Trek V is an atheistic movie.
It is.
Now, I don't want to try to reverse John Lennon-us. You know, I don't want people to go like, oh, yeah, our podcast is bigger than atheism. And I don't get angry letters from atheists or anything like that. Because atheism is a, you know, it's like Shatner, it's a belief system I do not disregard. And, you know, anybody who tells you that atheism is definitely wrong doesn't know what they're talking about, because we don't know. But here's the thing. When it comes down to selling mass entertainment,
yeah,
atheism is a tough sell. I mean, if you look at the summer of 89, look what crushed Star Trek V at the box office. A film that says it's better to be a psychologically damaged guy who dresses up as a bat rather than be ruled by a nihilist. And it also gets crushed by another film where Indiana Jones uses the cup of Christ to save his dad.
Right.
At least as far as our entertainment goes, we want God in the theater. if we don't want him anywhere else, you know, we want some uplift. We want some hope. Okay. And so Shatner is ultimately trying to make a film whose insight maybe, possibly at the very end, gets up to the level of stoned freshmen in the dorm. Hey, man, maybe God's inside us. Oh, wow. Yeah, it's a theologically flawed film that's at war with itself. In fact, given that, it's a wonder it's not worse than it is.
Well, everybody, there you go. Well, I'm not sure. So let's rewind a little bit and talk about the film in specifics. Okay.
Okay.
Jim, do you want to talk about the maybe at this point we should just throw the outline out. How do you feel about
Okay. So there was let's try to unpack what was said. I don't disagree that Shatner is approaching this movie from a perspective of he wants to do something. Like Shatner's a go big or go home guy.
Right.
Like Star Trek V, on the face of it, is ambitious. They go seek God.
Right.
Like that right there is a huge idea. It's not God's going to come to us. No, we're going to God.
Yeah, right.
Let's remove the execution. It's an ambitious idea.
It's like preaching in that sense.
Yeah. Now, this is where Shatner's hubris gets involved.
Right.
Because Shatner, at this point, he writes this outline. He pitches the script to Hall Bennett. Hall Bennett reluctantly signs on for this one because he wants to get part of the Producer Guild of America union. And he needs three producer credits, and he screwed up Star Trek III's producer credit, and he can't fix that.
Okay.
So he reluctantly agrees to come back to do another one of these. And he's featured as the Admiral Bob
that
he's talked to, so that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
So he pitches this idea. He goes off and he shoots one of these documentaries that we were talking about in like South America, and then he comes back from that, and he's like, this isn't the script I wanted, because the whole third act of the movie was going to literally be Colt's version of Dante's Inferno.
Wow.
Okay. McCoy and Spock were going to leave him.
Yeah.
He had to go back and rescue them from demons. And there was going to be like rock monsters. Like, this is where his hubris gets involved.
You write the script that's too expensive to shoot.
They don't. The studio has no interest in it. And what's more, Dee Forest Kelly and Leonard Nimoy are like, no. After everything my characters have been through, we are not turning our backs on Kirk.
Yeah, I read that. And I read that Kirk was like, well, or Shatner was like, well, if somebody had given me a script where they turned on Kirk, I wouldn't like it either. So I see their point there.
The cool thing about it is that is actually a really good part of that scene as well, where they say, no, we're staying here. We can't leave the ship. So it actually works really well for that reason. And I think that's something they definitely worked better than if they just said, no, we're off.
I hope you come back and talk about that. In my eyes, the real climax of the film is that scene in the observation room with Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and Sybok. But go on, Jim.
So this is what, you know, sort of like we're talking about making out. Like, Shatner keeps wrestling with the idea of the image of the movie in his head. And Shatner wanted to comment on Finding God.
Yeah.
And also wanted to comment on a thing that we haven't mentioned so far, which is televangelist.
Right, because he...
Like, in the late '80s, televangelism was a... Like, it still is huge today, but yeah. It's more niche. Like, this was... You had five television channels, and a sixth one that came in on, like, channel 32 was either reruns of classic sitcoms or it was just all Christ all the time.
And as I recall, Chris, you sort of rage watch these shows pretty regularly, don't you?
Yeah, if you follow me on social media, you know my Mystery Science Theater 3000 like viewings of Jim Baker are a thing I do, and I can't believe any. I'm pleasantly surprised how funny other people find them. That warms my heart.
Go ahead.
And that's where we get this Cybok character, right? That's where Cybok becomes the charismatic,
The televangelist character.
Yeah, the televangelist, like he's the one on the mission, and only through him can you get to God.
Right. Okay.
Like, only by giving him your pain are you good enough to reach God?
Maybe it's because I don't have a lot of exposure to the televangelist movement, but he sort of came off as a fairly straightforward cult movement leader to me.
Well, that's the thing. He comes off as a mess. You never really get a. I mean, I swear to God, I try to give this film a chance every time I watch it.
Sure.
And last time I thought, okay, here's the thing. Okay, Shatner's saying something about televangelists. Okay, he's with you in spirit, and you hit two huge. Well, okay, I'll narrow it down to two huge fundamental problems. Okay. Number one is there's this moment where all of a sudden, even the people that aren't mind controlled are on Cybok's side. It's like, wait, when did this guy suddenly become one of the good guys? When did everybody suddenly get on board with his plan? There's no redemption arc. He's just all of a sudden our friend now. We're on board with what he's doing now. And it reminds me, when I was a kid, it was a drive-in. Every now and again, you get a reel missing. And, you know, like the movie would skip ahead 10 minutes and you'd be like, wait, what happened here? And secondly, and it's just something that just gets more and more evident to me every time I watch it. Okay. The guy that plays Cybok, Lawrence Luckinbill.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Or as I like to introduce him, Lawrence Luckinbill, star of nothing. He was like their eighth choice. And, well, and frankly, I would have called up number nine. He can't sell this character.
Well, I'm gonna
have and the funny and here is the tragic thing for me. Okay,
yeah.
Slumming in this movie and somehow not managing to disgrace himself is legendary British character actor David Warner.
Yes,
you make David Warner Cybok, and I don't hate this movie quite as much. I don't hate this movie half as much.
Who makes higher billing than Cybok?
David Warner, because he knows how to fucking act.
David Warner has like four lines in the whole movie, and he's in the credits he's listed before Cybok.
Yeah, I found it weird because I was trying to spot him, and then I just realized, okay, it's that guy. He's not in it a lot. That's really weird.
Yeah, but I'm gonna so. Okay, you obviously your opinion of Luckinbill is pretty straightforward, but I'm gonna have to say I think that's a really subjective opinion, and I just don't agree. I found that he actually really sold the character when he wasn't doing the share your pain bit. I thought that when he was just talking to the characters, when he was talking to Kirk, when he was talking to when he's talking with Spock, for example. When he's explaining his plan, for example, I actually thought he was pretty compelling, and I liked him. But
I'm just gonna say, no Star Trek, like this movie, I feel uses everything in Star Trek canon, or at least it tries to.
Okay.
And the fact that the cold open is two strangers in a desert, and one of them's a laughing Vulcan.
Yeah.
Like right there, and then you kick to the opening theme song. You're like, what the fuck is going on? Like, a laughing, but like you automatically, as a viewer who's seen all these films, as someone who's seen all the TV shows, if this is the first time you're watching it, you're already intrigued by this charismatic presence, because you're like, he's got pointed nails and he's laughing. What is he, a Romulan? Right. No, he said he's a Vulcan. He did some sort of like mind thing with that Strangel. So we don't have a name for it.
The opening of that film, I see Shatner trying to ape the great Omar Sharif entrance shot from Lawrence of Arabia, and I'm thinking, I remember sitting in the theater in 1989 going like, oh shit, Shatner's in over his head. And then it goes from that to the Next Generation theme. What the hell is going on here?
It was either Lawrence of Arabia or it was a Western. It was that kind of riding in through the dust.
There's a lot of like Lawrence of Arabia. There's a little Western or a lot of Western at Paradise City. There's it felt like a little Road Warrior with the sort of cobbled together guns.
Yeah, that's weird. Yes, there's a lot of weird stuff going on Nimbus 3. They really should supply some technology to them, because they are in a shit show down there. So
and maybe even a little Dune going on whenever I see a desert planet. But I remember I read the novel. Go ahead.
It is a creative misstep that we open with a desert and we end with a desert.
I do
always cop to that. Like, that is that's a bad choice. Like, if you want to put paradise in a desert, give me something visually different. Because Misty, you know, my wife, we watched these movies together. She told me and goes, oh, so they left one planet just to come back to that planet? And she's not wrong, because visually speaking, it's not the only thing that they add is that purple gradient for the sunset sequence, and then that completely vanishes when it goes to night.
I read the novelization to this movie before it came out, sitting on the floor of the Save-On drugstore, and. I pulled the book off and I just started reading, and I remember reading the first page, and I don't remember the name of that character, that you know, Cybox follower is how he's credited, but that character on Nimbus 3, who's like trying to put a rock in his improvised air rifle so that he can defend his field full of holes, and then he sees Cybok and says, you're a Vulcan, and the Vulcan laughed. And that's actually how the first chapter ends. The Vulcan laughed. And I remember, like, wow, what the hell is this? But then now with hindsight, it makes me think of Spock Messiah. You guys remember this novel? It's one of the original series novels before any of the films ever came out, in which Spock is the sort of messianic figure. And I have very vague memories of the novel. I did read it, but I was just a kid. And I'm wondering if there's a connection between that book and this film at all, because again, we have a messianic Vulcan who is Spock's brother, and it just seems too much of a coincidence.
You know, I think probably a more direct antecedent would probably be the Star Wars movies than that book. I mean, honestly, if they'd tied into that book, that would have been cool. Yeah. But I mean, the whole Cybok being Spock's brother, it just seems to be, you know, nobody was willing to budge on the betraying Kirk thing, so they decided to take the lazy Star Wars way out and say, oh well, you okay? His brother shows up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always a bad thing where you get some guy's brother show up. Yeah, and the worst thing about it, I quite like Cybok. I quite like the guy actor that plays him, because again, another one I've not seen for ages. The idea it's his brother, very poor. But the idea you could have basically said, okay, this guy follows the old Romulan ways before the breakup, and they go into all that kind of stuff. That would give some more depth to him, rather than just say, hey, is this random guy that just does nothing? And it's like, there should be a bit more background to like the movement, and Spock could have explained that. Oh, they broke away and did this, rather than just went, oh, he's my brother, and he went a bit mad.
All right, now I know what he's going to say, so I have to give him time to say it.
Go.
Okay. So my rationale for why the brother thing works for me is that when you watch the original series, and again, my whole viewing of this is like, this is just the original series with a slightly bigger budget,
right?
And William Shatner unleashed, like, that's what this movie is, and I can accept it and I love it for that. Is when you watch Journey of the Fable, After Sarek and Amanda are on the ship, Kirk phones the Spock and says, "What, we're going to be in Vulcan for the next couple hours if you want to see your dad." And Spock says, "Sarek is my father."
Yeah.
And then, like, Kirk doesn't know. Like, the idea that Spock is such a private individual that even with his you know, the guy who lights up every time he sees him, he goes, "Spock." I mean, right. He doesn't tell him that his dad is the Vulcan ambassador.
That they've just met. They've already met.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
as you put it to me once, when Discovery started and we got Burnham and we explained Burnham as being Spock's half-sister or adopted sister, and I was like, I don't believe it. Like, I can't believe they're inventing a new sibling for Spock out of nowhere. And you said, Spock doesn't talk about his family. Like, the canon is there. Spock is a very private person, doesn't talk about his family.
It's almost as if Sarek could have gone, it's like, yes, meet my son. Ah, no, there is another. It's like,
and there is a line in Sarek in the TNG episode where they talk about one of Sarek's sons marrying and Picard being at the ceremony. They don't say Spock.
Right.
They don't ever say Spock in canon.
They like do it's not on the line. Name, yeah.
So that could be another son of Sarek that we don't know about. I prefer to think of it as Spock, but then the question is, who the hell is Spock marrying? And you know, my fan is like, oh, it has to be Savick. You know, I Nurse Chapel finally got her one day of happiness before
she died. The Nurse Chapel. Okay. Chris, I have you described this film as having a muddled message. Did you already touch on that, or is there more that you want?
Well, there's yet another muddle we haven't gotten into. I briefly touched upon it. Okay, all right, okay. So, like I said, I almost got into this film thinking about it being a statement on televangelists, which seems to be a very, very, very narrow thing to base a big budget movie on. But okay, that's fine. Okay, so Cybok gets followers by doing telepathic things to them.
Yeah.
So Shatner is trying to equate religion with brainwashing, which is a valid point.
Yeah, McCoy even.
That's because religion, like anything else, can be perverted and made wrong and made evil. And the thing is, if he would have just stuck to that version of the character, Cybok is a bad guy who mind rapes people.
Okay.
There you have at least a solid through line. You still have Scotty banging his head on the ship and fart jokes. And it's still a movie I want my money back from. But at least there's a consistency to the villain.
I remember belch jokes. I don't remember fart jokes.
Oh, they make a joke about Bones beans being explosive.
Oh, that's right. Yes, thank you. Okay, I see.
But Star Trek 4 also has a fault joke. They will
We did Star Trek 4. Let me finish on Cybok, and then
that's what that smell was.
Okay. Okay. All right. So yes. Shatner wants to make this big statement that religion is brainwashing. And then again, there's this missing reel where all of a sudden we've all forgiven Cybok and we're on board with his quest. To use a pro wrestling turn, Cybok does a face turn and we're not allowed to see that episode. He's done absolutely nothing to redeem himself from all the people that he's mind raped. And now all of a sudden, you know, he's their buddy. He's their pal. Hey, it's our old buddy Cybok, the one who mind raped my crew.
When I watched the show, I didn't see it like that. I saw it like, okay, once we get through the barrier and we're at the planet, he lets everybody go and he says the ship needs its captain. And now it's like, well, okay, we got all these issues with Cybok. Those issues we're not going to address right now, but we had this planet right in front of us and now we're here.
Why do you particularly need this guy who's mind raped your whole crew? Explore the planet, throw this motherfucker in the brig.
Yeah. Right.
So, but the Cybok's, it depends again, how you see Cyborg's powers as being. If it's technically is mind control, valid point. If it is unlocking your hidden depths of, you know, despair, maybe he is doing what he says he's doing. So it's a weird one. But
bottom line, a point like this should not be vague.
Yeah,
it just
that's
goes
true.
To show that Shatner is punching above his weight class in this one.
You definitely get the impression with the other crew members that it is literally mind control. When Spock and McCoy kind of just say, no, we can't leave the ship, then you kind of get, maybe it's not. But again, we'll get to that later on.
Let's talk about that sequence, because we've referenced it once already. So this is fairly late in the movie. It's like sort of the end of the second reel. Or even later, Kirk and Spock and McCoy have been captured, and they've been placed in the observation deck. And the room is very darkly lit, and Cybok comes in, and basically we get kind of a first person version of whatever his mind control powers are. Before, we've always seen it just kind of working invisibly between two people as Cybok talks. But now, and it's weird because it's very different than the others, there's a kind of visual hallucination, which apparently everybody in the room can see, which is weird.
That's what I hate about it, yeah.
Yeah. And the first one, at first, I don't think that's clear. Like, at first, it just seems like it's inside McCoy's head because Spock and Kirk don't really talk about it or interact with it. And so I buy that first one better when it's McCoy visiting his father, and eventually he sort of disconnects his father's life support system. And Kelly totally sells that scene. Like, I buy it. I thought it was great.
And Cybok also kind of does a thing where he kind of sweeps in, says a couple of words, and sweeps out again. So you definitely get this kind of a mindscape thing rather than a physical representation. But then you get like shots of Kirk going, oh yeah, we can see what's going on over there. And it's
the light from Spock's birth is shining on Kirk's face.
And he's like, weird.
Yeah. And now it just gets kind of weird. It kind of goes off the tracks. Jim, what do you think? Now, I wanted to ask you about this scene in particular, because most of you don't know this, but Jim's written various Star Trek stories and other stories along the way, adventures or Star Trek plots. And the ethical dilemma around euthanasia is a recurring theme in your work. And I was wondering if it comes off, what's that's relationship to this scene?
It's this moment. Like this movie came out in 89. I'm 6 or 7 when the movie, like when I see the movie.
Yeah.
So this scene is like just emblazoned in my head.
Oh.
As my wife commented in the other room, at this point, I was deeply religious.
Yeah.
When I saw the scene originally.
Yeah.
It's a very inspirational scene for me in terms of like, what is the right thing? Like Kelly is in the Kobayashi Maru.
Right.
He has no, like in that moment in time, he can either allow his father to suffer for as long as maybe another person has a cure, possibly,
maybe.
Or he can, you know, preserve his dignity. And and his dad, who we can only imagine is, you know, similar to the Bones that we meet in the TV show.
Presume we don't have anything else to base him on.
We have nothing to base it on, right? We have nothing to base it on except for the fact that at the end, when his dad is dead, Deforest Kelly cradles his face, lovingly cradles his face. Like there was a connection. And that he then suffers this loss and then has this additional guilt by the fact that Akio comes out. So it's just this idea that comes into me, like, you know, quality of life is more important than the number of years you live. Like
survival is not enough, as the Star Trek line goes, right? Survival is not enough.
Yeah. Like life has to have dignity and meaning, and it can be the meaning that you read into it.
Yep.
It can be the meaning of like maybe God's in the human heart. Like it can be those pithy things, or it can be, you know, it's what you define it as. And at that moment, his dad's in pain and he does the loving act. Like, I love the observation scene, like from when he goes in there and Cyborg sells him, like the Romulans call it Voltavol. Like, just like the way he, and you know, the Andorian name is unbeknownst. Like, just the way he just sells all these lines. Like, that's sort of like, I don't see Cyborg as bad guy. Like, he is antagonist, but he's not the evil of Khan. Like, Khan is motivated by vengeance.
Right.
He's not the angle of Kolg or these other villains that we've seen in this series. Is he misunderstood? A little bit. And I think that's what the movie tries to do. I don't think, to Chris's point, they successfully land that ship.
Right.
Because even when I watch the movie, when Cyborg looks to God and goes, "Why'd you do that to my friend after Kolk's been electrocuted?" I'm like, okay, friend's a strong term. I call people friends and I actually fucking mean it. Like, the idea that this guy who's taken over my ship is just calling me a friend.
There's a great deleted scene where Shatner goes, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, Cyborg, hey."
Yeah, right? Like, whoa. Really, at this point, we're kind of just walking together only because I'm allowing you to.
Yeah.
Back to God.
But then when we see Spock being born, because we've watched all these movies in sequence, I immediately thought of his reunion with Sarek at the end of 4. When Sarek is like, he doesn't say it this way because he's a Vulcan and he's Sarek, but basically he says, "I'm proud of you." And I thought, well, Cyborg should have watched the last movie, because if he had, he would have known this wouldn't work.
And the deleted scene that I posted on my Twitter account and I'll chat, says Spock goes, "No, that's not gonna work. Like, you've overplayed your hand. I've already settled my father issues." And then Cyborg turns the tide and is like, "What about the abandonment of your elder brother?" And then it's a 98-minute scene with the two of them in shadow and Leonard Nimoy throwing his voice as if he's a boy.
Right.
Which is the best thing about it, calling to his older brother that he wants to go with him. And I think it's a much more powerful moment, and I'm sad that it's cut from the film proper, because as the film stands, like, Spock kind of just walks off like Gimli from the Lord of the Rings cartoon.
Yeah.
Like, when I see Balin's grave, he just kind of walks off out of camera. Like, that's sort of what Spock does. He does the Gimli walk, is what I call it.
Yeah, I noticed that when I was watching it. It's like, but I thought that it was an attempt to make the film, to make you think that he had fallen for it, but he hadn't really. And if you were paying attention, you could realize that Spock had made his will save.
Mm-hmm.
To use the game term. and so then when he says, I cannot go with you, we realize, oh, that's why he hasn't said anything for the last 2 minutes, is because he resisted.
And like, I love the fact that McCoy has to spend inspiration points to make the same decision. Like, Spock is resolute in that.
Yeah.
And McCoy's like, I guess that makes two of us.
I guess, yeah. What he said. Yeah.
And well, if you gamify it, it's great.
Go ahead, Jim. I'm Chris. Chris?
Thank you. You know, kudos to the film for bringing up the whole euthanasia and quality of life thing, but I've never really, really cared for how it ultimately plays on film. And I tell you where it completely falls apart for me.
Okay.
You know, I unfortunately had a close family member go through a period of extended hospitalization. Everything's fine now.
Yeah.
But one of the things that you appreciate around hospitals is, even in 2020, you can't just walk in and pull the plug on people.
Right.
There are like 17 alarms go off. And about, not that I tried to pull a plug or anything. It's just I had a lot of time to observe this equipment and talk to the people that deal with it on a daily basis.
Yeah.
It's just, I can't imagine that there are less safeguards in McCoy's time. You know, how McCoy got away with this and didn't get, unless you know, they're a lot cooler about this, about that sort of thing in the 24th century, which would be a whole other better story than the one we got on the screen. You know, it just doesn't play right. I mean, he pulls the plug and nothing else happens. But I tell you how I made that work for me.
Okay.
To me, the scene is so divorced from anything that we know about Bones before or since. It really fed into the thesis that Cybok is a mind raper. He's not making you relive what actually happened. He's making you relive the worst possible version of it.
Guess I didn't feel that way necessarily on my part, but I
see. And the whole thing about them finding a cure, I just that's like a wah wah trombone noise with the way it comes off in this film. It's just another crazy coincidence that's just lipstick on this poor misbegotten film trying to make this whole concept of, you know, Bones and Spock, or at least we're at least going to tease Bones and Spock turning on Kirk. And it's just it's a long walk for no result. And, you know, it's an idea worthy of a much better film or a much better episode.
Just my opinion. We have another person in our audience, Aspie Snow 99. Thank you. Said she's a big fan. They're a big fan. We had a quick request for our favorite film in the series and least favorite. Go around. Favorite, least favorite. We know Jim's favorite is this one. Least favorite?
Least favorite. Toss up between Nemesis and Into Darkness.
Chris?
Are we doing all Star Trek films together, not just the classic ones?
All Star Trek films together.
Tie between Into Darkness and the first Abrams Trek. I hate them beyond all reason or measure.
What's your favorite film?
Favorite, I hate to be so boring, but I don't think they've yet to stop. They've yet to top Star Trek II.
Yeah. Eight.
It would probably have to be again Into Darkness. Into Darkness stopped me watching Star Trek from Beyond for absolute years because I just thought, second one was rubbish. That's fine. I'll leave that behind. Favorite out of. I do like Generations because it's the first big screen Next Generation. Sure. I adore Star Trek VI.
Now,
Star Trek VI is the next one, so I'm looking forward to this. Okay, I've not seen it in a while.
You're going to have plenty of time to tell us what's so great about that movie when we get to it. Good. I am like Chris. I don't think I'll ever recover from Star Trek II: Wrath of Khan, which will always be my favorite Star Trek movie. But there's always hope for the next best one. Like the rest of you, I think Into Darkness is it's so bad, people. It's so bad. I have to side with that. All right, so let's get back to the film and try and talk about, we have a little bit of time left. And like
to talk really quick.
Yeah.
The set design in the observation lounge, I know it's a redress of Tenfold.
Right.
It's a much smaller space than Tenfold is.
And it's dominated by the wheel, by the steering wheel.
It's just a gorgeous looking set.
Yeah. It is.
Just with the little nautical touches and the fact that it's in the forward section, you know, evocative of the later Tenfold. Like most of the sets here are reuses of Next Generation. And it's painfully obvious that we're trying to make it smaller. Like the transporter room, like they just put up a wall. And I'm like, it's still the, like, Chief, this is Transporter Room 3. Like, little mic crossover between Scotty and Chief O'Brien. I want that. But just, like, the kale and the attention to detail in the observation line, like, just the fact that the floor has an outline of a compass, like a map compass is on the floor. Like, just the nice little touches in that space that I think shows what the production could have done had the studio allowed them to have a budget, and they won't focus so much on giving Shatner his Dante's Inferno ending.
You know, and one thing I want to note, that one weird good thing to come out of this movie is the Nimbus 3 Adventure Zone in Star Trek Online. Like, I don't know if any of you have ever played this game other than me, but Star Trek Online is a 10-year-old MMO, still going strong, with an entire cast of Discovery on it now. And they've got a whole adventure zone, like a whole planet built for Nimbus 3. and players from all the factions, whether you're a Romulan or a Klingon or even a Cardassian or a Dominion guy, you can beam down to the surface of Nimbus 3. You can go into Paradise. You can go into the bar. You can get in a dance contest with the cat lady. There's a whole bunch of plot and story involved there. Like there's this, you remember when you go into the bar, there's this television with an advertisement by this kind of like merchant guy. Sell you starships or something. Well, that guy is like a boss. He's like one of the bad guys in this Nimbus 3 plot line. He's an Orion pirate, and he's got a gang of Orion flunkies that you have to wade through and shoot, you know, and then captured innocent people, and there's all kinds of stuff going on. And you can see the people who made the MMO thinking, well, let's have something from every movie. Like, we've got to have, we want to tie into every movie somehow, because every movie, as this episode of our show is testament to, is someone's favorite Star Trek, right? Every film is someone's favorite Star Trek. And so but how do they tie into it? Well, we can't use Shakari. We're not going to go back to the God planet. We're not going to go through the Great Barrier. What are we going to do? Well, obviously, we're going to use Nimbus 3, and they do this whole sort of adventure zone in it, which is kind of cool. We touched on Paradise a little bit, and we talked about some of its influences, but let's rewind a little bit. I had a question for you guys. What is the point with – there's this whole subplot that the Enterprise is, quote-unquote, put together by monkeys. That, like, everything is breaking on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any reason – for this plot, other than number one, early comedy, so we can have a bunch of comedic bits like Kirk trying to read the briefing tablet that's got system error, and the second part, which continues throughout the film, of the transporters not working. Is this plot is the idea that the Enterprise is cobbled together and not ready for spaceflight? Is that solely so that they have to use shuttles to go everywhere and not transporters?
I think you nailed it. I think it's that really painfully, it's a source of the painfully forced, unfunny comedy that just seriously weighs down the film. And to use the old, will the transporter work thing that we've seen 80 kajillion times before.
Yep. And if you're going to have a small band of mercenaries take over your ship, you can't have 400 people on your ship.
Oh, the skeleton crew. They do that.
That's why it's a skeleton crew.
Oh, yeah. This is illegal. This bugs me. This is the one thing that, again, watching it, it's like, oh, you're the only ship in the quadrant currently around Earth where Starfleet is at the moment.
Okay, now, I have to clarify because he actually says, I know you're not the only ship in the quadrant.
Oh, does he? I thought he said, well, you are the only ship in the quadrant.
No, you are not. But, he says,
I need Jim Kirk.
Yeah, right. You're the only experienced ship in the quadrant.
So they could definitely pick up crew from Starfleet Academy. Come on. That's like, if you can bring Kirk up, you can bring up at least some. Oh, you're working in the offices now. Yeah, you used to be a lieutenant. Up you go. There's no need for that. A security force would be nice. Like we get the two guys with the riot shields.
Yeah.
But some more of them would be a good idea.
It's just a hostage situation. Why would you need security help?
Yeah.
So let's talk about the hostage situation. So we meet these ambassadors. We've got, what's the actor's name again that plays
David Warner?
David Warner, who of course is a brilliant, and actually we talked about because he was in Time After Time, wasn't he?
Yes.
Where he plays Jack the Ripper.
And we'll be in six.
But David Warner is the Terran ambassador, the human ambassador. And then we have the Klingon general, who I actually, he's got, for all the weird parts of this movie, he's like one of the very few characters that actually has a story arc.
Right, yes.
The Klingon ambassador is the drunken guy who got exiled, put out to pasture, as Kirk phrases it. And by the end of the movie, he's like making the young Klingon captain apologize to Kirk. And it's kind of a cool moment. I like him. And then there's the poor Romulan who is just literally just a pretty face for David Warner to put his arm around at the cocktail party at the end.
in a movie full of bad performances, I dare say that she is the most screamingly terrible actor or actress in the whole thing.
Exactly, you're given anything to work with, Chris. I mean, it's this. We have to play some of the script here.
David Warner has the same crappy script, and I still come out thinking like, "Hey, David Warner, he's still one of the best actors you've ever heard of."
Go ahead, Jim.
There was still 3 minutes. There was a 3 minute deleted scene where the three of them talk more, and basically the Klingon is just sexually harassing Caitlin Dahl.
Wow.
And I'm super glad it was cut. Like, it was so bad, I didn't even post it on my Twitter account to be like Hail Star Trek 5. Like, I'm like, no, I'm curating that.
Yeah, okay.
No one needs to see the light of day.
She's just so non-Romulan. That's the just her attitude, the way she talks. I mean, what we've seen forever. I mean, they're always portrayed as being highly secretive. Oh, no one's seen the Romulan family yet. And this one just seems to be like, are you actually a Romulan? Because you don't seem to. Yeah, it's really weird. I mean, she does have that kind of a flirty attitude-y kind of thing going on, which obviously we see in Picard with their Romulans. You wouldn't know she was Romulan unless they literally called it out.
And this is before, like, I'm trying to imagine, remember when the Romulans get established in Star Trek Next Generation. And isn't it season 3?
End of season 1 is Neutral Zone.
Okay.
Last episode, season 1, Neutral Zone.
So there's no explanation, there's no defense then, because we'd already established Romulans in Next Generation, and we should have been pulling from those Romulans just like we're pulling from the Klingons.
Yeah, they've got that kind of square-shouldered look. They've got the haircut. Yeah. Everything. There's nothing in that at all.
That 80s box look. Mm. The wardrobe director probably said, no way I'm putting her in that thing.
That's probably true.
All right, so does Nimbus 3 have horses on it just because William Shatner collects and rides horses?
Yes. Yeah, Shatner admits it. I mean, there's not much else we can say about
that. Okay, I was guessing, but it turns out that there's actually evidence for that.
Yes.
Okay, well, that was a short question and answer. All right. Aid, why is Nimbus 3 in the Romulan neutral zone?
Yeah, again, don't get it. Makes no sense. It's like, hey, this is the planet of intergalactic peace. We're going to put it in this place. Anyone that visits those breaking the treaty, so you're all going to get blown up. Makes no
sense. Well, so you put it like that.
I don't get it. How do they get supplies in? I mean, that obviously probably means they haven't got supplies. That's probably why they're so piss poor. But the idea that they've got, like, oh, this is the best place to put this planet. It's like, that makes no sense. And again, it's unnecessary because it doesn't even add to the plot. There's no Romulans in it to come up and say, well, you're in the neutral zone. So it's like, why is it there then?
All right, now skipping forward towards, because there's a lot of there's a bunch of this film we haven't even talked about, like the whole opening, the whole Yosemite sequence. Jim, you probably love that sequence.
See, I was sort of saving this from like my closing thought. I know we're hitting an hour.
Yeah, we're almost an hour, so we should probably. I mean, I want to talk. I have one last burning question of mine, which is I have two. Before we do final thoughts, when Cybok jumps into Godhead and wrestles with evil Cybok, it reminded me of Lazarus from the old episode, The Alternative Factor. And I don't remember all of the original episode series very well. And there's actually some episodes I have never seen. Famously, For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky, I have never seen that episode. But I remember Lazarus for some reason. It kind of burned into my head. And I think it's because of that image of the two versions of the character wrestling in the sort of, you know, antimatter-matter tunnel that they connect. And when I was watching the film last night, I wondered, is there a connection there? Anybody? No?
I don't think it's intentional.
Okay.
I think this movie, one of the joys I get from this movie is there's a lot of unintentional callbacks. Like Patterns of Force, Spock is on Kirk's shoulders to get out of the prison. Yeah, like he's doing the thing with the light bulb.
Yeah.
After they've been whipped. In this movie, like Kirk gets his comeuppance. Like Kirk, I don't think it's intended for that. Like I don't think that was designed in it. Like the galactic burial equals Great Burial, that kind of concept.
Yeah, like, that's weird.
We've had these concepts in Trek, and I think they'll just spilling into it as opposed to being like intentional, like world building.
Now, my other burning question is, there's a well-known story that the ending of this movie was cut, was truncated because they ran out of money. And there was going to be a big fight between Kirk and a bunch of rock monsters that all got cut. And it was only sort of that by miracle, they managed to get the special effects looking even as good as they are.
Although, and they're the worst of all the movies.
Yeah, there's the worst effects in all the movies. But the idea was that it was frankly, it was unscreenable, unreleasable until they made some sort of last minute edits and they kind of pulled a miracle out to get even last place. But of course, the rock monster story makes me think of Galaxy Quest when the captain of Galaxy Quest fights a rock monster. And I was wondering if that was an intentional callback to all of us Star Trek nerds who know the rock monster story from Star Trek V.
I've always thought it was. But there was just so much, like, we should really review Galaxy Quest at some point.
Yeah.
I think it's very likely it was something to do with it, yeah.
Yeah.
The idea of the failed rock monster. Yeah. But, I mean, that whole sequence, again, you can literally see where the money runs out. As soon as those pillars of stone erupt from the ground, you go, okay, soundstage, okay, everybody, turn it black. I mean, it's very similar to the original movie where it's like you go in, they go inside and it's all just black around because they just need the actual pod. They don't need anything else. Everything else is just blank.
When they're inside.
Yeah.
All right. So, Jim, we're going to give you last word on this. Anybody else have anything to say before we give Jim last word?
I have something because we haven't mentioned as well. But Chris, you go first because you're much more interested in that.
Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, well, you're too kind, sir. You're too kind, sir. Well, first of all, two quick thoughts here. First of all, I've always thought it was interesting, perhaps even a bit ironic, that given Shatner and Roddenberry's fractured relationship, that Shatner wound up making the most Roddenberry Star Trek film that Roddenberry was not personally involved with, because Star Trek V boils down to you can kill God with a photon torpedo because he's a fake.
Right.
And that, you know, giving how strongly religious 4 is going that direction in 5, you know, it just sort of underlies what a great contrast you have between the two films.
Right.
And until J.J. Abrams started making Star Trek films, this was my ultimate proof that 5 was the worst of the lot.
Okay.
As the people that made that film will openly admit, their great grand goal for this film was to get Sean Connery to play Cybok.
Right.
Apparently, they offered him script. They offered him some input on the script. They drove a big truck of money to his house, and Connery turned them down. So this is a guy who said yes to Zardoz.
Yeah.
This is a guy who said yes to Highlander 2. This is a guy who said yes to League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, but Star Trek V, he goes, this is too big of a piece of crap. I can't be associated with this. Sorry. No, this is, the movie's terrible. I can't do this. It doesn't hit Highlander 2 levels of quality for me.
Okay.
Sean Connery also toned down roles in The Matrix and Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, well, good. Well, you know, I mean, hey, you know, you know, we've established that Sean may not be the best at picking scripts, but seriously,
that's my faint little
final thoughts on the film.
Okay, so one thing we didn't mention is the inclusion of the Klingons.
Yeah.
Why the hell?
Yeah.
It's like they remind me of 50s teenagers going around looking for trouble. That's literally it. They're just driving around in their spaceship. Hey, let's go and mess up that Kirk chap. That'll be a good idea. Let's go and do that. And they don't do anything. They don't do it. They're not even
tires and like key is gone. Yeah.
They're completely pointless. They're not even remotely a part of the plot, apart from literally, you know, shooting the guy at the end. But they could have done that with Enterprise if they needed to. There's no need for it.
Right. But you know, just, for my money, that Klingon captain, Glenn Danzig's finest moment on film.
Yeah, again, they got the look. Yeah, so that's good, but that's weird. But also, I can't remember if we have mentioned the idea that Kirk actually questions God and that's one of the coolest things ever. I mean, that's just the idea. That's like, excuse me, brilliant.
The line, "Why does God need a starship?"
Yes.
is more famous than this movie.
Yes, it's just again, whether or not that's anything to do with Shatner's ego or Kirk's ego, it's excellent.
You know, it points to the tragedy of this film because Jim marvelously kept using the word hubris in describing this film. Yeah. Shatner desperately wanted a movie where Kirk and where Bones and Spock turn on Kirk. And the answer was right in front of his face, to let Kirk be the one who was wrong. And the fact that that's the one idea that would have worked and never occurred to him. It just kind of shows you why this poor thing was born under a cross star.
I have not watched this film probably since it first came out. And I watched it again last night. And it wasn't, it was okay when I was watching it. Like, there were parts of it that I liked. And many of them are parts that other folks specifically do not like. But overall, I was sad because I felt like the film kind of fell flat at a lot of points. Like, it just was kind of going through the motions, and the action scenes aren't very exciting, and the humor is just kind of dumb, and I felt like, as I often feel sometimes these days when I look at some of these movies, that the performers are ill-served by the people behind the camera. That the writing and the direction is not as good as the people in front of the camera. I mean, we've taken a lot of shots here at some of the actors in this film, but I thought that they were doing the best they could with, quite frankly, crap sandwich that they were handed. And there's moments where those actors' abilities really rise up, and they give a hint of what this film might have been if it had been better written and maybe better directed.
I mean, the plot fundamentally comes down to nothing more than Cyborg Hitch's journey to God.
Well,
because there's no real conflict. There's a bit of a conflict on the planet. Then they get on the spaceship. They spend most of the time flying across the galaxy having some discussion, because there's not even any fighting there. It's just like Cyborg turning people and jokes and da-da-da and, you know, Scotty knocking his head out, that kind of stuff. And then they get to God, and then that's it. And it's like, it was just a road trip. This is literally just a road trip.
I was trying to analyze the plot afterwards, and I thought, okay, so this is what happened. There was this alien entity, this very powerful alien entity, that pissed somebody really powerful off. Of course, now we've later established that it was the Q continuum or something, but that this being was very powerful and bad, and so it got trapped on this planet. And then it can't get out because of the barrier. So it's been reaching out, and it makes contact with Cybok, who's kind of a victim in this sense. He was asking questions, right? But because he's got very powerful psychic abilities, the God entity is able to make contact with him and kind of turn him to his side and manipulate him. And we see this kind of finally pop at the end when Cybok's like, "What are you doing? And why would a loving God hurt people?" And the God thing is like, "Well, I'm not God. You just thought I was God. I'm the God you thought I would be." And maybe that's why the novel always seemed much more plausible to me than the movie, because in the novel you could explain all this stuff, and you could make Cybok, you could present him as a kind of tragic character who was being misled rather than the cult figure that he comes across as in the movie. That's not the movie we got. I want to stress, we didn't get the movie that I wanted to see, which is the God thing is the antagonist. Mm-hmm. And Cybok is just a victim who gets manipulated into doing these things, and who, honestly, by the end of the movie, feels pretty terrible for being used. Like, not only did I get used by this God thing, but I did all these terrible things to other people because I thought I was right. But I'm not right. I'm incredibly wrong. And now I, I've got to pay. And like a lot of great film characters, he realizes he's done something wrong, and so he has to pay the price for it, and that means self-death, keeping God thing busy long enough for, as we put it, blowing him up with a photon torpedo.
The thing about this is all is it also establishes that Cybok is his psychic abilities are so powerful that he can receive messages from across the galaxy.
Yeah.
Which generally speaking, you wouldn't think that's a normal Vulcan thing. Because obviously they'd all be bombing off of Vulcan, going everywhere all over the place. But then they do it in Discovery with Spock, for exactly the same way with the Red Angel, and it's like, okay, can we just not have people that can do kind of like extraordinary things, but not Superman extraordinary things?
Well, to be fair. That goes all the way back to the original series. Spock senses the Vulcans aboard the Intrepid dying from several light years away and in the immunity syndrome.
About to counter that.
So we're delving into the Force. Okay, that's cool.
All right, so Jim, bring us home on this picture.
All right, so the reason why this is my favorite film, like I can make a case saying it fits very comfortably in the season three, extended episode of the original series. I've seen the original series so many times that now when I'm just scrolling through my Twitter feed, I'll see a random picture of Culkin Spock and be like, oh, it's from this episode.
Yeah.
With nothing else in it. Like, I've seen it so many times. And the reason why I keep coming back to the show, the reason why I keep coming back to these films, the reason why they take up so much hit space is I like the character work. Like, I care about Culkin Spock and McCoy around the campfire. I care. Like, I think that the Uhura Scotty relationship in this movie that's hinted at is very touching and sweet.
Yeah.
Like, two long-term co-vocals have just decided, you know, maybe we'll give this a shot. And the fact that there's no follow-up on it is tragic for me, because it's like, what happened to Uhura? Like, we get Scotty in the future. Like, what happened there? On the fact that it's not even mentioned in like Star Trek VI, they just go back to colleagues.
Yeah.
Seeing the fact that Chekov and Sulu decide to take short leave together and they wind up getting lost, and they're the helmsman and navigator, respectively. Like, I find those things endearing. I find the humor to be sort of tongue in cheek, playful. It's not exceptionally funny, it's not like haha funny, and it's trying to be that, but I sort of feel like it's as my wife has said in the background, I am charmed by it.
Okay.
So this movie, I find like it's ambitious. It tries to do a lot of things. It doesn't successfully land everything, but I think the character moments that we get in the film make it a worthwhile entry in the series. And I think it's the most representative of what Star Trek is, as opposed to what either Star Trek can be, like Star Trek II, or you know, what Star Trek isn't, which I think is mostly motion picture, because Trek wasn't that. Like, Trek is malleable. Like, that, let me get that out there. Trek is very malleable, but when you're talking about the original series is set in tropes. And this film, either intentionally or unintentionally, sort of revels in those tropes.
I see. I got you. So it's like a toy box, and they're playing with the toys.
Yeah. And I don't make it, I don't say it's a good movie. I don't love it, ironically. I love it. Like, genuinely love this film.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you, everybody, for watching. We're going to move on to Abe's favorite film, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, next one, which I just love because it got a lot of Shakespeare in it and Captain Sulu finding his ship. So thank you. We'll be back next week at our usual time. And thanks to the people that came in and listened and watched this week. And we hope that you join us again next time. Thanks, everyone.
Cheers.